Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Today we are joined by Lee Eric Schmidt, the Edward C. Mallinckrodt Distinguished University Professor in the Humanities at Washington University in St. Louis. And he's also a faculty fellow at the John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics. From 2009 to 2011, he was the Charles Warren Professor of the History of Religion in America at Harvard University. And before that, he taught at Princeton, where he was the Agate Brown and George L. Collard Professor of Religion, as well as the chair of the Department of Religion. He has held research fellowships at Stanford and Princeton, and also positions courtesy of the National Endowment for the Humanities, the American Council of Learned Societies, the American Philosophical Society, and the Guggenheim Foundation. In 2015, he was appointed a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians. Holy moly. And I think he did all this before age 18, so all you millennial kids take note and get off your dusty butts. Professor Schmidt is the author of numerous books, including Hearing Things, Religion, Illusion, and the American Enlightenment, Restless Souls, The Making of American Spirituality, Consumer Rights, The Buying and Selling of American Holidays, Holy Fairs, Scottish Communions and American Revivals in the Early Modern Period, and Heaven's Bride, The Unprintable Life of Ida C. Craddock, American Mystic, Scholar, Sexologist, Martyr, and Madwoman. His latest book, Village Atheists, How America's Unbelievers Made Their Way in a Godly Nation, was just released by Princeton University Press and is the topic of our discussion today. All these books and more will be linked on our website. Lee has appeared on a number of NPR programs and other talk radio shows to discuss his books, including All Things Considered, Talk of the Nation, The John Batchelor Show, The Bob Edwards Show, and now I say, Research on Religion, most likely the crowning achievement of this distinguished career. Lee, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. It's great to have this chance to talk with you, and I've been waiting a long time for this kind of media break, so
yeah, I know.
For having me on.
You told me one time you were waiting 15 years to be on Research on Religion, even though we've only been around six. So,
exactly.
That's how prescient you are. So, yeah, no, that's great. It's a good chance to have you on the show. I had a chance to meet with you in St. Louis a month or two ago, and it was a delightful conversation. And you wrote a very, very interesting and very readable book. I love history books, and people who write history well are people that we should celebrate. And for all you folks out there, this new book, Village Atheists, is a fantastic read. Now, you've written pretty extensively about religion in American society, with a lot of your focus being on the 19th and bleeding into the early 20th century. But now you're turning your attention to atheism. So what motivated you to write about Village Atheists?
Well, you know, I've worked my way across the spectrum, I think, on American religious history, or at least one spectrum. I started off, you know, early in my career, really interested in evangelical Protestantism and its history, and kind of moved more into liberal Protestant currents, and then beyond them to, you know, seekers and folks who dabbled in Buddhism or became Baha'is or became interested in Vedanta. And then there, you know, once you're in that kind of post-Protestant world, another step to take is to think about these free thinkers and atheists and non-believers. And so in some ways, I see it as an unfolding trajectory in my career. But even in graduate school, back in the old days, we had note cards, and I would keep this the running list of things that I thought would be good to write on at some point. And even then, I was just fascinated. I was working more on the 18th century at that point, by the fact that, you know, by most accounts, only 10 or 15% of the population were church members. And so I kept thinking, well, what about all these other people? What about the unchurched? And, you know, what could we say about those folks? So from even early in my career, I thought this would be an interesting direction to go. And now, you know, in the early 21st century, there's just been such a growth of the religious nuns in ONES, the disaffiliated, now up to about 25% of the population, that I think historians and sociologists and scholars in other disciplines as well are paying more and more attention to this group of people who are religiously non-believing or disaffiliated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's just something that to note that you did, and I think this is a good lesson for a lot of graduate students and younger scholars, is to keep these note cards of things that you see along the way when you're doing your dissertation project or your main project, because there's always questions that appear and you can't address them all at one time. But if you have this box filled with all these note cards, you can usually come back to them. It just probably explains why you've been so productive with so many books, is that every book you write suggests three or four others.
Right. Usually there is just that kind of connection. There are these loose ends at the end of projects and you kind of follow them out and see where those go. So yeah, that's definitely been a pattern for me. And I don't think I have note cards anymore. I'm sure there are other ways of doing it. Of course, now, but back then, yeah. Lots of note cards.
I still use the note cards and the little sticky pads, because they things on the computer get lost for me. But
that's true.
The note cards also get scattered all over the floor too. So that, anyways, let's get back to talking about these atheists here. You've written a book that starts at roughly the end of the 18th century, and you note that Thomas Paine was one of the first vocal atheists to challenge the notion that the United States was a highly religious country. And as you noted here, there's been a lot of sociological evidence from folks like Roger Finke and Rod Stark to show that religious practice was not as high as we might expect back then. But nonetheless, the cultural landscape during this period of time, during the 1700s and 1800s, was one of high respect for religion, especially Protestant Christianity. What was the religious landscape like for non-believers? How did they fit in, if at all?
Right. Yeah, definitely there's that sense, right, that it's just the right thing to do, the decorous thing to do, to put some time in church, to show up and be in a church pew on a Sunday. One gentlemanly advice guide said, even a wise atheist, if there could be such a thing as a wise atheist, would know enough to do that, to keep up appearances, to keep up pious appearances, because otherwise you wouldn't have any credit in the world. You would just not be deemed a socially trustworthy person. So there are those kind of cultural expectations around a deference to, showing a deference to religious belief. That's clear. And there's also just this political economy as well, where even John Locke thinks you can't trust an atheist to be a citizen. There's just no way that someone who's an atheist without a sense of eternal rewards and punishments is going to be a responsible citizen. There's nothing to bind them to the social contract in an effective way. So there is a lot in the air there politically and socially that makes it hard to be an open non-believer. That just makes infidelity much more likely to be secretive or clandestine in some way. Now, on the other hand, in that revolutionary epoch, I do sometimes think it was easier in these more private, gentlemanly circles to be heterodox. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, in private is cutting out the passages from the Bible that he doesn't like. There's a dinner party when he's with this Connecticut artist, John Trumbull, prominent, Congregationalist, pious. And, Jefferson and the other people at the dinner just take apart Trumbull's Christian faith, and he leaves the dinner enraged that how could these atheists be talking about like this about religion. So there's a way in which I think in those kinds of settings, you could get away with more heterodoxy. Now, you can't imagine politicians now thinking that it was a good idea to sit around and talk like that and provoking their Christian guests at dinner. So sometimes I think there's a little more room or flexibility in those enlightened circles to express heterodox religious opinions, that there was, on the other hand, just more interest in engaging those ideas, I think, as well. So it kind of cut both ways. On the whole, the public side of this is that non-belief is kept rather furtive. De Tocqueville said, that people know to keep their unbelief to themselves. They don't want to be, they don't want to risk that kind of public rancor and distrust. So I think that's the prevailing mood or sentiment. But every once in a while, you see the ways in which very heterodox opinions are able to be expressed in some of these elite gentlemanly circles in ways that would surprise us, I think.
And one of the things that you did, too, was document how expressed non-belief would lead to some penalties in society, and some of them seem pretty harsh. Could you review some of those?
Right. Well, you know, a big controversy for these free-thinking deists in the 19th century, early 19th century, is that there are penalties against atheists in terms of testifying in court, that a witness could be deemed incompetent if he was known to be an atheist and could just be disqualified because you couldn't trust that person's word if they didn't believe in God, or if they wouldn't profess a belief in eternal rewards and punishments. You couldn't trust the word, so therefore you could disqualify that person as a witness. So that was one of the ones they fought a lot. It comes up in de Tocqueville. He's in a New York, there's a New York case he hears about where a witness is summarily disqualified for being an atheist. And that happens from time to time. There are enough of those stories where witnesses are disqualified, right, throughout the 19th century and even into the 20th, that you can see that as a serious civic impediment for non-believers and atheists. So that's one they really concern themselves with, those kinds of requirements, courtroom requirements. Now, you know, earlier, of course, there could be, more severe penalties in the colonial world for, you know, expressions of irreverence, fines and imprisonment and things like that. In the 19th century, there's still people prosecuted for blasphemy from time to time and ending up in jail or fined for their irreverence. So blasphemy law stays on the books, into the 20th century, but there are numerous cases in the 19th century of people being locked up for blasphemy.
So this seems to be a pretty tough environment to get around. There's the social pressures, you lose the ability to testify in court, run for office, and then possibly even end up in prison. But we start to see things start change in the early 18th century. There's a little bit more open space for this non-believing crowd, and they start to take advantage of these cracks in the cultural pavement, I guess you could say. Give us a sense of why this starts happening and how does it start happening?
Right. So, you know, there's already in the revolutionary period a world of deistic dissent, and that's there, and there are deist lectures and a few deist journals. And so there's a fair bit of expression of free-thinking dissent, you know, in the early republic. By the 1850s, there's actually a handful of people who are just out and out atheists. I mean, usually in the earlier period, they talk more about being deists or maybe free thinkers. By the 1850s, you get people like Ernestine Rose, who are open atheists. And then one of the characters I talk about later in the book, Elmina Slinker, who comes out as an atheist in the 1850s. That's really the first group of people at these infidel conventions in the 1850s who are embracing the label of atheist and, you know, wearing it proudly in public. There aren't many of them, right? It is still kind of seen as a slur. It's clearly a slur, but there are people now doing it. And, you know, in some ways, as they see it, it's a natural kind of intellectual progression that deism is a compromise, and that your materialism just advances the point where you just honestly are able to proclaim your atheism, because that's the logical conclusion you reach when you work out this naturalism, this strict naturalism ends in this kind of atheism. So they would see it as an intellectual a progression that they've moved down that path and are now proudly proclaiming the end point of the journey.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned something that just piqued my attention, and actually this caught my eye in the book too, and my imagination ran wild, that there are these infidel conventions by the 1850s. What happens at infidel convention? Imagine seeing balloons and people, you know, doing atheist stuff. I don't know what.
Well, you know, these aren't really well attended events. It's a small group, usually in Philadelphia, New York. They meet. I think they actually in Boston. They're usually advertised to this one newspaper, the Boston Investigator, which is a free thought paper started by this blasphemer Abner Kneeland, and they'll attract a few dozen people, maybe, sometimes a bit more, sometimes a bit less. They give a lot of speeches. These are conventions organized around oratory and people standing up and making speeches on behalf of their materialist worldview or their secular political orientation, or in the memory of Tom Paine as this noble hero. And so there's a lot of toasting Tom Paine at these kinds of conventions. I mean, it's kind of, there's a hero worship around Tom Paine. And so you might read passages from Tom Paine or recall Tom Paine's life. You put out the kind of secularist worldview through oratory in those settings. That's both a kind of their metaphysical propositions, but also their political propositions about the relationship of religion and the state and things like that. That's what goes on at an infidel convention. And that's a lot of what's going on at, these other conventions after the Civil War that become somewhat bigger, where these free thinkers gather and things now, instead of called infidel conventions, usually things like the National Liberal League, Liberal Leagues, and the American Secular Union. They're carrying on that platform that you see really come together for the first time in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about these infidel conventions, you say there might be a dozen or a couple dozen people giving oratory to one another. Is it just themselves, or are they doing this to the general public, to inviting other people in? And
well, I mean, you know, they're open, and they're not attracting a lot of positive attention.
Right.
I mean, they're getting publicized in the newspapers. Like, can you believe we have an infidel convention in town?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not particularly respectable, and they aren't going to attract, big crowds of well-wishers or anything. But they do publish their minutes. They do publish, usually in the Boston Investigator. This is their big journal. They usually will publish the speeches from the conventions. And a lot of one of the things they do is they spend a lot of time figuring out what to call themselves. I mean, like, is it a good idea to advertise yourself as an infidel?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you be better off calling yourself something else, like a secularist? They will argue over that in the 1850s, because infidel is obviously a derogatory term, and the question is whether you can redeem the term. Just like Methodist was a derogatory term, and the Methodists ultimately redeem it. And the question is here, can we wear this badge proudly, or should we come up with a new badge with less baggage to it?
Yeah, why don't you talk a little bit about that, the embracing of names, the debating of names, who they are, what they're going to be, free thinkers. But before you do that, I just had to chuckle when you were talking about these infidel conventions there, where they were giving speeches to dozens of their fellow followers. And I kind of thought, wow, we do that at academic conventions still today. I mean, I give long-winded speeches sometimes up to six people in the room,
and
they do
exactly
the same thing for me. So.
Right, right.
Things never change, I guess.
Yeah.
But this, interesting, you call them infidel conventions, and they do kind of embrace this name at that point in time. But you spend some time in the book talking about how these people are going to label themselves. They are kind of a, odd fellows group in a culture that is really heavily pressing Christianity on everybody. And so how you market yourself to a wider audience is going to be important. So tell us how they wrestled with the name thing.
So they have a lot of options, and they run through them. I mean, they after the Civil War, they stopped generally referring to themselves as infidels and preferred some other names. Through the antebellum period, infidel often emerges at the top. They see it as a name they can redeem, and they will use it. But even then, they have other ones they're thinking about. Well, maybe we should just call ourselves liberals, because that's a really broad, inclusive term. But others will say, no, it's too broad and inclusive, because you could invite alliances with religious people, like Unitarians. The spiritualists might think of themselves as liberals, and so that won't do for some of them. Others think materialists. Others think it should be a focus on their kind of moral philosophy, so they think of themselves as philanthropists or humanitarians, so they'll put the emphasis more on the constructive sides of their unbelief and want to emphasize the kind of moral program of free thinking. So they go through all of those. And secularism comes on the scene in the 1850s. It's a British import term. It's thought to be a more constructive term. You know, like, who wants to be known as an atheist? Who wants to be known as an infidel? Those are slurs. They're just things that mark you out as socially deficient in your community, not a part of civil society. So let's come up with secularists. We wear that badge. We can emphasize our kind of positive political program, our positive ethical worldview, and we can build up our community around that. But if you're a hard and fast atheist, you think that's a complete sellout, and say, you know, I'm not going to be a secularist. That's just a silly wishy-washy thing to say, and you're not being true to your total naturalism and materialism, so we're going to keep atheism. So they go back and forth like that. And really what I see throughout the period, but certainly in the late 19th century, they're just using all of these terms interchangeably. And they can hardly sustain a difference between what it means to be a secularist and what it means to be an atheist, or what it means to be a free thinker, or what it means to them to be a secular liberal. So they just have a welter of options. And if you look in this secularist community today, I mean, they're still debating, like, the name issue comes out again and again. Like, is it better to be called a humanist? Doesn't that sound more constructive and a little more warm and cuddly and maybe a better publicity tool than calling yourself an atheist? I mean, won't people respond better if you say I'm a humanist and not an atheist? And then an atheist will say that's, you know, again, just too soft. It doesn't makes a harsh point you need to make. So those kinds of debates are really apparent by the last decades of the 19th century, and you see them still. People still arguing in those kinds of ways in these secularist communities over the best way to mark oneself.
So they have all these different names that they use. Your book uses the title Village Atheist to give these folks a moniker. Why did you choose the term Village Atheist?
I liked it because it has a range of poetic and literary associations to it by the 1920s. And it starts off in the early 19th century when it's first used, mostly associated with these kind of drunken local infidels, followers of Tom Paine, village blasphemers, and so it's mostly negative. By the 1830s, I mean, Emerson invokes this idea of a village blasphemer in the Harvard Divinity School address, and that, you know, that the congregational minister, the Orthodox minister, can't stand up to this figure. This figure is able to kind of scare off the Orthodox minister, and so there starts to be an image of contrarian dissent. And Unitarians, after the Civil War, run with that and start redeeming the figure, rehabilitating the figure as one of courageous nonconformity in the face of village pieties and complacent orthodoxy. And so by the 1910s and 20s, there's quite a bit of that. Van Wyck Brooks, the literary critic, says there's no more important figure in our social history than the figure of the village atheist. And so he says that because he sees it as a figure of of contrarian dissent. Someone who's able to stand up and speak his, usually his, or her mind in the face of these pious conventions. So I liked that history of the term. It's not the most common. I mean, people would use freethinker and infidel or simply atheist more frequently than they use the notion of village atheist. But I liked some of those literary poetic qualities to it, and that I liked how it puts the emphasis on the local and the everyday, that figure who's embedded in a community who's taking these stands for unbelief in the face of the ecclesial norms that dominate the town.
Yeah,
and I liked that local everyday quality that I thought the phrase brings to mind.
Mm-hmm. And it was reflected in the book cover, too, which is a really nice book cover. We'll put it up for people to see on our Facebook page and on some of the other social media we use. It's one of these cartoon or pamphleteer drawings that was very common in the late 1800s, and that's going to get us a little bit here to one of the cartoonists of the era. But it really fits nice. I love book covers, and I know people say that you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but I judge your book by its cover, and it's a great book. So,
well, that's good. I like the cover too. I thought the designer did a really nice job of capturing the flavor of the era.
So, despite all this dissent over what they should call themselves and how they should emphasize things, is there any unifying themes that brings together these village atheists / freethinkers?
Sure. Right. So there are all these different names. Is there anything holding these groups together? And I concentrate on a handful of things. One is that they're all critics of Christian orthodoxy. They really are critics of a range of Protestant orthodox doctrines, broadly Christian doctrines. And then they gradually move out, you know, from the denial of the virgin birth or miracles. They move on out toward deism and then finally to atheism. So there's that theological route they're traveling. They're also very committed to the strict separation of church and state, really to the person. They care deeply about that. They have a very strict construction of what that means. They tend to view the world in terms of this warfare between science and religion, that Christianity has been this inveterate foe of science over the long haul, and they're standing for science against Christianity, and then they see science as this path of progress toward enlightenment. They're anti-clerical. They don't like ministers. They don't like priests. So they're constantly ringing these anti-clerical bells, and they have a kind of universal social ethic, civil rights orientation. I mean, this matters a lot when they're speaking about their constructive vision. You know, in the details on that, they aren't ever very clear. I mean, like on race issues or women's rights, actually, there are a lot of different visions there. But they have, in a broad brush way, a kind of moral universalism they're espousing. And then they're relentlessly focused on this world. So all of those things, you know, come together to form these village atheists or these freethinkers, and you'll see those. All of those themes sounded one way or another, and all of the figures I talk about in the book.
And you do talk about these in terms of figures. A lot of people view this as an intellectual movement, but it is a movement that's built upon some very interesting personalities and personas. And again, in a culture of heavy Protestant Christianity, it takes somebody of a unique and peculiar character to kind of break out of that mold and to put their ideas forefront. And one of the most interesting observations that you make in the book really kind of relates to what this movement is about. I'm going to read a short passage here that you say. You state early on that the religious estrangements that vexed them, the village atheists, were not philosophically abstracted. They were visceral, relation, and densely particular. They were rarely sophisticated metaphysicians worrying over the niceties of epistemology, but instead aggrieved contrarians stunned at the moral shabbiness of the scriptural stories of the manipulative theatrics of popular revivalists. First of all, that's a beautiful sentence. That's just, I love that sentence. But what do you mean by all of that?
Well, I mean, one of the things is, you know, certainly there are highbrow elements, right? I mean, you could tell this, as an intellectual history and really concentrate on, you know, kind of the Bertrand Russell strand of the story somehow. You know, that's not the strand that I think matters in the 19th century American context and really into the 20th century. It's much more local and everyday. I mean, these are battles that people are fighting over the Bible, over scriptures. It's especially a battle for these people with evangelical Protestants, with Methodists and Baptists and Presbyterians. And so, you know, for example, I tell this story of this one-armed atheist in Industry, Kansas, a small town, Industry, Kansas, and his name is J.B. Wise, and he's in this long fight with this evangelical minister whose name is actually H.P. Venom. The minister, of course, is doing, you know, from one week to another, he'll say something against infidelity and unbelievers, and this J.B. Wise just challenges him. He will challenge him face-to-face, he'll invite speakers to town to challenge him. He's just a thorn in the side of this minister, Venom. So eventually, you know, after several years of the back and forth and them dumping on one another, Wise decides to send him a postcard through the mail, and he just puts one Bible verse on the postcard. And the Bible verse is from Isaiah 12:36. It's the Syrian taunt of the besieged people of Judah. And it says, among other things, "Hath he not sent me to the men that sit upon the wall, that they may eat their own dung and drink their own piss with you?" Okay, so it's a scatological reference. Wise thinks it's just amazing that that's, you know, in the Bible. And he wants the minister to face up. Well, isn't the Bible kind of filled with obscene or scatological stories? And what are you going to do with this passage? He just puts that on a postcard. No commentary, just that. Well, the minister is so outraged to get a postcard in the mail that he decides he's going to see if he can get Wise arrested on an obscenity charge, because he sees that, you know. And everyone, all the freethinkers think, this is amazing. Wise is going to get arrested for just copying out a piece of scripture. And sure enough, the sheriff comes down from Topeka, hauls him off to jail, and he can't make bail, so he's in jail for 5 or 6 weeks and eventually stands trial and is convicted, given a token fine, and released. And then he goes back to being an infidel. But that's the kind of thing that, you know, I emphasize. It's that on-the-ground battle with a minister between this village atheist and this minister, and they're fighting over a Bible passage. And there's nothing, you know, there's nothing really deeply sophisticated about that fight. It's not a highbrow fight. It's a face-to-face combat over the Bible, and then over the power that Christians think they can wield over non-believers by calling in the law. So there's a lot going on there. But that's the kind of thing that I want to put the emphasis on in that passage. That's a story that illustrates it. But they're also fighting over revival meetings. A lot of times, of course, this being true in Kansas or in other towns where these people are hanging out, you know, of course, the Methodists come in and they have their camp meetings or their revivals. And there's always a kind of like sense that these kinds of dissenters, these atheistic infidel dissenters, are the object, you know, oratorically, in sermons and these evangelistic calls of the revival meeting, like trying to single them out or talk about them in some kind of way. So they're often fighting over that. They're often fighting. They'll either come to the meetings and listen to them and express their dissent, or they see themselves as in opposition to those evangelistic techniques. So those are the kinds of conflicts that I think are really shaping this kind of village atheism and in American culture. It's those those kinds of battles. And so those are the kinds of things I want to bring out in the book, is to see it in those kinds of ways. And sure, there's another story that we can tell in the highbrow intellectual history, the reception of Darwin in American culture or something. But even there, I think you'd really look at it more as a kind of street battle or public school battle over the spread of those kinds of ideas.
Yeah, the stories that you tell are very vivid, very colorful, which makes it a really fun book to read, because I always like these peculiar stories. Why would anybody do something like this? You're just poking people.
Right.
And you, what you do is you make this a technique in the book, and I think this is extremely effective, that you have a couple key individuals in the movement that emphasize different streams of thought / approaches to becoming village atheists. And so I want to walk through some of those. One of the first ones you start off with, and you always have a nice moniker for each of these people. The first one is Samuel Porter Putnam, and you call him the secular pilgrim. Talk to us about Putnam and why he's called the secular pilgrim.
It's a name he takes for himself. He, once he becomes this roving lecturer for secularism and free thought, he starts off as a Congregationalist minister, becomes a Unitarian, and then eventually he leaves the Unitarian ministry and becomes instead this roving, free-thinking lecturer. And because he's moving around constantly in that role, he starts describing himself that way in these accounts he writes up at his lecture journeys, that he's this secular pilgrim. Now, it has more significance than that, than merely describing his itinerancy, in that he really does see himself as a counterpoint to John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. I mean, this is a book he knew as a child growing up. His father was a Congregationalist minister, Orthodox Calvinist, in New England, and he grew up with that book and imagining his life as this Protestant pilgrimage to heaven. And so what he creates when he writes his own life experiences, an account of his own religious experience, is a reverse pilgrimage. The atheist turning his back on the pursuit of the heavenly city, the celestial city. So he becomes a secular pilgrim in that way, in that larger sense, as someone who's a paradigm of the reversal of that absolutely central Protestant story of pilgrimage. So that's why I dwell on that moniker. I think it's richly suggestive at that level of really seeing how there's now this counter narrative to Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress out there among this secularist minority.
And what was the approach that he took, and who did he also influence? How is he representative of some other folks of the age?
He does a lot of different things. I mean, he has when you're a minister, you have a clear role. I mean, he has a vocation as a Congregational minister and a Unitarian minister. And then once he leaves those things, he's not sure what he is, right? I mean, there are only very few people at that point who can imagine themselves having a full-time career as a secularist, as a kind of secular lobbyist or a secular lecturer. So he's got to create a sense of what it means to have that secular vocation. And so one of the things he does is he wants to write the whole history of the movement. He takes about a year or so off from itinerating everywhere in his nonstop speaking engagements to write this 1,000-page history of free thought around the world, but especially in the United States. And in that, he takes this carefully observed biographical perspective, which in many ways I'm playing off of in my book, where he's looking for people who exemplify this secular pilgrimage. He wants to give dozens of these examples of what it means to become a secular pilgrim, what it means to live this life of non-belief, to live this life beyond Christianity. And so he picks characters who will display this. And then he tends to write their story in very neatened up secular ways. So he'll take a character like Robert Adams, who's an American free thinker, and look at his life story and kind of make it look like it just had to end in atheism, it just had to end in secularism. And then so the religious complexities of Adams' life get brushed to the side, that he was part of the Plymouth Brethren, or that he was part of a Siemens mission movement for a while, there's a neatening up, a biographical neatening up that he wants to do. And when he encounters these figures who don't, play it according to the script he wants, like he has this friend, George Cheney, who's really an exemplary infidel. And in the late 19th century, he's on the exact same trajectory that Putnam is. Goes from being, I think in Cheney's case, a Methodist minister to being a Unitarian minister to ultimately being one of these independent free thought kinds of ministers. The problem is he doesn't stop there. And so he's one of Putnam's best friends and closest confidants. And then he decides he goes to one of these infidel conventions or free thought conventions and announces he's become a spiritualist and now has, an angel guide. And not only that, he's running off to California with a medium to start, an occult journal called Gnosis. Well, at that point, Putnam can no longer tell his story at all. He wants to just, he writes him out of the movement entirely. Mm. This is one of the things that Putnam does. He wants to create a template, a script for what it means to be a good atheist or a thorough materialist. And in doing that, he has to kind of tidy up all these stories that just don't fit his history, don't fit his model. So he's doing that. I mean, and he has a lot of pages to do it, and you can see exactly what he's doing by who gets thrown to the side, who's thrown under the bus by him when he's telling this big history. So he does that. There are other things he does, but that I think his big history is, a lasting accomplishment of his, in that he really did document the movement in an incredibly thorough way. And without that big 1,000-page book from the 1890s, we'd know a lot less about these people.
Yeah. Well, preaching sermons and writing a 1,000-page book is one way that you could tell the story, but there were other media available to atheists at this time. And one of the most fascinating chapters in your book that deals with the life, thought, and legacy of this guy named Watson Heston is that he was a cartoonist. And cartoons, or kind of pictographical sketches, really becoming popular in the 19th century as the cost of newsprint was decreasing. And this guy takes full advantage of it and is probably the most enjoyable part of the book, because you have a couple dozen of this guy's cartoons, and they're very detailed. The drawings are very exact in many ways, but then they have tons of writing all over them. It's little things that you can find in crevices of the pictures. It just absolutely fascinating. Tell us about this Watson Heston guy.
Watson Heston almost took over the book for me. I mean, you probably can tell that with all those illustrations. I mean, I think the chapter it ends up being by far the longest, partly because of all the pictures, but partly also just because he did. He became an absolutely absorbing figure to me. He creates more than 1,200 of these cartoons, these irreligious cartoons. They become a dominant medium for the movement, for unbelievers. You take great delight in these images. And you can document the delight, because they write letters to the editor by the dozens telling the editorial staff at Truth Seeker magazine how much they love his images and how they're using his images and where they're putting his images on display. So you can really create a rich history of how these images are being used, how people are responding to them. You can find out when they think he goes too far and when they think he's too insulting. So you can really create painstaking work, but you can create that kind of picture. You can also, nobody's written this guy's biography before. But with enough labor, you can kind of paint that picture too, as life of kind of destitution and marginality in this little town in Missouri, in southwest Missouri, and how he manages through perseverance and you know, one moment of good luck to get the gig with this journal in New York, publishing all these cartoons. So, I find his story compelling, but I also then think his art, as you say, is really engaging. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's at a lot of levels. I mean, it's coarse, it's rough, it's insulting, and you have all kinds of debates that come out of that. But there is something very compelling about it. They are multi-layered, like you say. They're almost little. Oftentimes, he'll, like at Thanksgiving, for example, he doesn't like presidential proclamations because they're filled with religious language, and he can't, you know, that's a violation of church-state separation, but it's also just bad theology in Heston's view. So he writes his own Thanksgiving proclamations and put them in his cartoons. You know, so there are, like, textually dense as well as, you know, visually compelling. I was completely drawn into Heston's story. I mean, it has lots of layers to it. And, you know, I only got to use maybe one out of every 20 or 30 of his cartoons, but I tried to give a really good representative sample of the art.
Yeah.
You know, but when you've got 1,200 to work with.
Well, we'll put some up on our Facebook page, and I'll turn folks to the book too, just for that chapter alone. I mean, the book is great entirely, but just for that chapter alone, it's a great read. There's one cartoon in there that really stuck with me, and this was on page 100, talking about the undesirable immigrants, and there seems to be this kind of merging of two streams. Protestants were very concerned about Irish Catholics and German Catholics and Italian Catholics coming in near the end of the 19th century. And it seemed to, I thought that was largely a Protestant thing, but here you have Heston doing this cartoon where you have bishops coming out of the water or the Atlantic Ocean, and their hats, the big pointy hats that they wear, are made to look like alligators. And I've seen this in pro-religious or Protestant Christianity cartoons, and now in this atheist one. Was this the guy that came up with that one, or what? How did these two themes, or these two different strands of, you know, Protestant Christianity and atheism kind of blend into this, oh my gosh, these undesirable immigrants?
Right. Yeah, this is, that image, I mean, those Episcopal hats turning into crocodiles or alligator mouths. I mean, that's a knockoff from the cartoonist Thomas Nast, and occasionally... Yeah, okay. Heston does have these knockoffs, especially his anti-Catholic imagery can be, he'll even sometimes say, with compliments to Thomas Nast in a couple of his cartoons, because he knows he's kind of borrowing a visual trope from Nast. So he's fully enmeshed in that wider anti-Catholic iconography that's popular in Protestant circles. So on this particular point, really, the free thinkers like Heston and, you know, Episcopal cartoonist like Nast, they're on the same page in their anti-Catholicism,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, and their anti-immigrant nativism, you know, some of those, they can be on the same page. So they have, now the difference, of course, is that Heston is anti-clerical across the board. Right. So it's a sweeping indictment of all religions. So he'll turn around and make equally biting and ugly images of things Protestant. And whereas, you know, Thomas Nast is superintending in some ways that middle class Protestant world. Heston is pressing an across-the-board critique here, and he shares that in that anti-Catholicism. So that's there. There's really no gap on that point. That would be one of those places of clear overlap between secular liberals and Protestants. They share a deep anti-Catholicism.
Fascinating character. You have a few other fascinating characters here. Somebody you call the Blasphemer, Charles B. Reynolds, and I love that title because it sounds like a Batman villain or something, the Blasphemer. But we're running a little short in time, and I want to go to one of the other characters who's very vivid and colorful here, and one you might not expect because it's a female. You normally think that these is kind of a male-dominated movement here. But you talk about somebody called Elmina Drake Slanker, who you have the title of the obscene atheist with a subtitle of the sexual politics of infidelity. Do tell us about this.
No doubt, right? This is in all kinds of ways a male-dominated world, and you still see, and a lot of times people will criticize the new atheist as a kind of hyper-masculine preserve. And Slinker confronted that in her days of activism in these ranks from the 1850s, when she comes out as an atheist as a young woman. Through the end of her career in the first decade of the 20th century, she's constantly needing to remind her fellow freethinkers, shouldn't you occasionally include a woman, in your kind of pantheon of atheist greats or freethinker greats? She'll look at these conventions and they'll only have men, images of men, Tom Paine, Robert Ingersoll, or what have you up there. And she'll say, surely you can find a noble free-thinking woman to include alongside these men. And so she's constantly fighting those kinds of battles in these ranks, trying to get the movement to think more seriously about marriage reform or gender politics or reproductive rights or reproductive control. She allies herself with those kinds of movements, this one reformer in New York City, Sarah B. Chase, and it's because she's willing to make that leap, and not all freethinkers, indeed, perhaps just a minority of freethinkers, are willing to make that leap into these gender politics. That's what gets her arrested for obscenity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the opening wedge. When Anthony Comstock and his fellow agents go after her, they know she's an infamous atheist, and they don't like it. Hmm. It's easier for them to get her once they know she's also doing all this stuff on marriage and sexuality. And, there's a significant record for them to investigate on that. And they do arrest her and hold her on obscenity charges. So that becomes, toward the tail end of the book, where I see the shift is, it used to be you primarily go after them on blasphemy charges. With the advent of the Comstock laws, the more effective way to go after these aggressive unbelievers and infidels is to find a way to charge them with obscenity. That's a more effective charge. And that's exactly what Comstock does in Slinker's case and any number of other cases. But yeah, so that's where the obscenity comes in, but there is always this, it's twofold, right? I mean, Comstock can't stand the fact that she's this monstrosity of being a woman who's an atheist. But even in her own ranks, there's a way in which her being a woman and an atheist is seen as odd and an odd kind of challenge to the basic masculine conventions that are governing this free thought world as well. So, Heston has this cartoon where he always pictures the freethinker as a white male in the prime of life, always. The only time he actually pictures a woman atheist freethinker is Elmina Slinker, and it's a picture of her under the boot of oppression, like prostrate on the ground, voiceless, speechless, after she's been arrested for obscenity. The only way he can imagine one of these women freethinkers, he can't give them the same agency, the same liberty or presence or voice that he constantly is able to give somebody like Robert Ingersoll or Reynolds or Putnam in his images. It just doesn't hold. So she's fighting a tough battle on multiple fronts in being a woman atheist, that's for sure.
What kind of legacy does she leave? Does she leave a big mark on this movement into the 20th century? I mean, she passes away in the early 1900s, but is there a legacy that she passes on?
She's Well, it's interesting, right? I was talking with Annie Laurie Gaylor, who's one of the leaders of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. I was talking to her yesterday, actually. And she did a compilation called Women Without Superstition, a book called, where she put together documents and brief bios of a lot of these different free-thinking women. And she did do one on Amalia Slater. So she is not forgotten. That's for sure. But she, you know, she's not exactly someone, no one had written this kind of biographical portrait before. No one had kind of gone out and done this at this level that's here. So she's not forgotten, but, you know, she's not the big figure like Elizabeth Cady Stanton. You know, obviously there's been a lot more work done on her as a suffragist, who's also a free thinker. So there are legacies of these 19th century free-thinking women, for sure, and they're still lifted up from time to time among early 21st century secular activists. But Slinker, she's living in this little town of Virginia, Snowville, Virginia. She, you know, is considered just persona non grata in her town. There's not a lot of way for her to have any kind of institutional legacy in that setting. So it takes some real historical work to bring someone like her back into view, I think. That's what I try to do, try to recover these kinds of stories so we have a little better sense of this world of dissent than we would have had otherwise.
Yeah, and it fits very well with the theme of your book of the village atheist, the one slugging it out there in the trenches on a day-to-day basis.
Right. She says at some point, you know, she's the only woman atheist anyone has ever met in any town she ever lived in. So, you know, it's a lonely town, I think.
Yeah.
Snowville, Virginia. Anyway.
Well, let me finish off with a couple questions here. I always love to ask my historian guests. One of these is, okay, you wrote about the 1900s or the 1800s, the 19th century. So what? What does this tell us about who we are today? Or is this just some historical artifact?
I think there are all kinds of legacies, right? I mean, we talked at the outset about the rise of the religious nuns, the disaffiliated, and, you know, we're up to 25%. And at least a third of that group are now, you know, openly saying they're atheists and agnostics. So, there's clearly a relevance, a growing relevance to understanding the religious or irreligious world of the disaffiliated, and then what that can tell us about our own world and that growing demographic in our own world. So, I think they're definitely places of continuity. I mean, you see it in a lot of the debates. I mean, you see it on the debates about gender and sexuality. That's still a very live debate in these secularist and atheist circles, where a lot of the, as I suggested, the new atheists are seen, as a kind of a male-dominated subculture, and there are lots of debates about that. There are debates about the cartoon debates. I mean, we know all these cartoon wars are going on over images of the Prophet Muhammad and whether the cartoonists have a right to offend, whether they have a right to ridicule, or whether that should be policed in some kind of way, rather because of the dangers to public order of giving offense through these images. So there's a real lesson in Heston's cartoons and how those kinds of issues get debated in the 19th century and the way we're still debating them in the 21st century. I think there are a lot of places of continuity. We had the debates in the 19th century. You know, could an atheist ever be president? Could a freethinker ever be president or be elected to any office of public trust? And most of the people in the 19th century say, no, it can't happen. They really feel utterly excluded from public office. And in the 21st century, you still get polls saying, who's the most suspect candidate? Well, most polls would say it's an atheist, right? They still can't get elected. Muslims sometimes come in now with equal levels of distrust, but basically for a long time, and still the atheist is right there at the highest level of suspicion for holding offices of public trust. So I think there are lots of things we can learn about the present by thinking about these issues as they played out in the 19th century. you know, this fundamental issue about whether religious believers and non-believers are equal in American culture, whether they're equal before the law, whether they're equal in social and political terms. You know, that's a long-running debate, and it's still a live debate in the 21st century, even though a lot of the court jurisprudence is lined up more on around the principle of neutrality. There's still plenty of room to think about those inequalities for a secularist minority in the culture, I think.
I think so, too. One final question here, and you've been around in the profession for about as long as I have. You've seen a lot of changes in the world over that period of time, and you've written a lot on a variety of different topics. Over the course of your academic career, have you changed your mind on anything, or has anything really surprised you that, you know, kind of knocks you on the side of the head and say, you know what, 25, 30 years ago, I never would have thought that way, but now I'm here in 2016 and the world looks a little different.
Oh, there are any number of things. I'll tell you, we're taping this 4 days before the presidential election.
Yeah. So
right now, I can't believe a lot of things are, you know, in this particular election cycle, things look vastly different. And I tell myself I spent a lot of time worrying about Mitt Romney that I should have saved my worry for 2016. So you know, right now I have a certain sense of something fundamentally different going on politically in the culture. So that's crowding in on me right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe in a few months I'll have greater perspective and clarity on all of that. I mean, one of the things I see looking back over my career and what I've worked on, there is a certain continuity around a certain kind of liberal Protestantism, I think, that is at an underground level kind of shapes the questions I get interested in and preoccupied by. And I think when I was first interested in evangelicals so much, it was partly, you know, in revival meetings and camp meetings, I grew up Methodist. You know, it was a kind of Methodism I grew up in, which was very socially progressive. But there was still this kind of evangelical air about it. And I think just being so interested in revival and camp meetings had to do with, you know, this other side of Methodism that seemed distant somehow. So I think there's, and then the ways I became more interested in these liberal, forms of Protestantism and post-Protestantism, it feels like a lot of the questions that have most interested me and really pushed me in my research come out of a relationship, out of that an underlying relationship that I'm trying to work out with liberal Protestantism. You know, so I'd say there's some continuity in all of that in the background for me. And, you know, and now in the early 21st century, it's just hard. The world is so different in terms of the place of ecumenical Protestantism, liberal Protestantism from the world I was born into in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. I mean, just the place of that ecumenical or liberal Protestant establishment in the culture was so vastly different than the 21st century. And I think in the early 21st century, I think a lot of us who grew up in that world are, you know, trying to make sense of the changed world we're in religiously and from that. That's true for me. I mean, in terms of, I can see how that larger religious transformation in the culture has affected my work over time.
Well, the world does march on, and we can take a lot of lessons from history, and we have great historians like yourself to help us along, tell us stories that have happened in the past and relate to them on how we experience our life here in the future. So appreciate you being on the show. My guest today has been Lee Schmidt. Lee, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.